The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Secrets of Communication, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Zev Ben Binyamin Olav Shalom, Mr. Walter Herbert Framer, of blessed memory.
As we explained in the last lecture, in the view of the Torah, Adam, man, is the crown of creation. According to the Talmud and Sanhedrin of 37a, every single human being is considered an entire world unto him or herself, with the universe, with all its beauty and grandeur, coming into existence solely with the purpose of serving mankind. But man, despite his exalted status, was not designed to remain alone and to function as a self-contained unit. As we know in Scripture, this is in Genesis 2:18, Lo tov heyos odom levado. It is not good for man to be alone. According to the Talmud in Yevamos in 62b, a person without a spouse is lacking life's full measure of goodness, happiness, blessing, Torah, and peace. And according to the Talmudic passage in Bava Basra in 16b, that we quoted in a previous lecture, without close friends, life is barely worth living. In other words, we were designed to go beyond the confines of our own self and to bond with others. The key to this bonding, this reaching out to other human beings, lies in our ability to articulate and share our feelings and ideas. Without the power of effective communication, our feelings and ideas would remain forever locked within, trapped inside a soul yearning to share and reach out. In fact, according to the Targum, the Aramaic translation of the Torah, the quintessential quality of man, the critical and defining quality that makes man so unique amongst the entire creation, is that variability of articulation and communication. Only through human speech can the full range of abstract thought and profound feeling find its full expression. But communication is not merely defined as the ability to articulate feelings and ideas through speech or writing. In the words of a song that I'm sure many of you still remember, it takes two to tango. Many of us have much to say or write, much to offer to enrich the lives of others, but yet we don't seem to find ears willing to listen or eyes willing to read. We talk and talk, yet no one is listening. Like two people who are hard of hearing and attempt to make conversation, we go through the motions, and yet we still remain alone. Tonight I would like to share with you some of the Talmud secrets of communication. I divided this talk into 13 sections, the first letter of the title of each section combining to spell out the dual acronym, Listen, Respect. For in the final analysis, communication is a two-way street. Only through your willingness to listen to others and let other people share their feelings and ideas with you, and only through the respect and concern you show to others, will you gain friends and partners that will genuinely want to listen to you and give you the opportunity to share your ideas with them. The first section, in the L of listen, we have listen. And here I quote in the notes a quotation from the Talmud, which in turn is quoting the book of Ben Sira. Ben Sira was a work which was put together in the 3rd There's a question of scholars, a third or second century before the Common Era. It's included in the Catholic Bible. It's part of the Apocrypha. It's widely quoted, even though it doesn't have biblical status in Judaism, but is widely quoted in the Talmud. And in it, it goes through a hierarchy of things that are frowned upon. A guest inviting other guests. You know, it's like I'm familiar with the folk story. And again, two lectures ago, we spoke all about beggars, remember? So very often, as it came out, that the beggars would line up on Friday evening at the end of the shul, waiting to be invited by the balabatim, those who had homes, who would invite them over for a meal. And in one particular case, a poor man was invited over, and as the host came to the door and opened up, he found not one beggar, but two. And he turned to the man that he invited and he says, "Who is this other man here?" And in Yiddish, it works out a lot better. It says, "Mein Adam of Kest." It says, the practice in Europe was that the father-in-law supported his son-in-law. Well, since he was a beggar, of course, the only way to support him was with his own skills and profession. This, he begged for him. So this is how... this is one of the no-nos. If you're a guest, don't invite other guests. It ends, though, and really this is the punchline, is that the worst is a person who replies before he hears the question. You know, very often, it is not uncommon. Someone asks us something or says something that is searching for comment, and before the person is able to finish, we interrupt and we start commenting and answering the question. This is frowned upon. And a source is brought, a verse from Proverbs. It says, He that giveth an answer before he heareth, it is folly and a source of shame unto him. And I'd like to dwell upon these two points. First, folly. A fool, at least in the biblical definition, the Talmudic definition, is someone who feels he has no pressing need to broaden his horizons and know more than he does right now. Because a fool feels he's a finished person. On the other hand, there's a quote from Pirkei Avos in the beginning of the fourth chapter. Ezehu chochem halomed mikol odom. Who is considered a wise person? He who learns from every person. It isn't a matter of how much you know, but how much you want to know. One of the great revered titles we give someone of intelligence is a philosopher. The root of philosopher really is a Greek term, philosoph, which comes from two Greek words, philo, which means love, and soph, which means wisdom. Again, the philosopher is not he who knows, but who wants to know, who treasures learning. And perhaps if we could just imagine, would be probably the most apt description of such a person. Imagine, if you would, a connoisseur, a collector of fine art, who discovers in a little known estate sale or antique shop an authentic work of art created by Rembrandt or Van Gogh, a painting worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, but due to the ignorance or the desperation of the seller, can now be purchased for a song for almost nothing. The joy, the enthusiasm on the part of the art expert is probably indescribable. Why? Because he loves art. He knows the true value of the work of the masters. And you know, because treasures like this, perhaps not a Rembrandt or Van Gogh, but other lesser-known artists abound. And sometimes in the most humble places, there are art collectors who actively seek out these places, and they make a practice of going off the beaten track to visit, you know, the antique shop or the art store in some, you know, in some winkel, some area that perhaps there's a little known treasure that someone hasn't discovered yet. If we could understand the love of the connoisseur for fine art, in a sense we could understand the love of wisdom that a true wise man has. And a lover of wisdom knows that wisdom abounds not just within oneself, but very often the most obscure places. And that, again, that's the source of the quote, "The wise man is he who learns from every person," because he's actively listening. He knows every human being possesses pearls of wisdom, gems, and he's just waiting to discover them. So on one aspect, the idea of listening is associated with wisdom, because a person who listens knows he has a lot to learn. He treasures learning. And I'd like to give another parallel to this, just to fully understand the notion of a person who loves to learn. And again, this is not formal learning. This is not learning from texts. This is learning from the wisdom of others. There is another quote from Proverbs. And here, the author of Proverbs, King Solomon, describes how do you test the worth of another man, another person. And he says, you test worth. And the quote in Hebrews, "Ish lefi mahalolo," a man according to his praise. And there are two ways to understand this verse. One is, you can tell a person how others praise him. Because if you don't know the person, find out, what do people say about them? What's the word in the street? That's one interpretation. One of the great masters of the Talmud, who lived in 13th century Spain, was Rabbeinu Yonah of Gerona. We've quoted him in another lecture. He has a different definition. He says, if you want to know the true test of a person, see what that person praises. What is the person excited about? One of the great Rosh Hashivas of the past generation, Rav Yitzchak Huttner, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Yeshivas Chaim Berlin in New York, explained the intent of Rabbeinu Yonah with the following illustration. Imagine, if you would, two people in a shul, in a synagogue. One is a rabbi. He's made the rabbinate his profession his whole life. A man of immense learning. The other, seated close by, also absorbed in a book and a sefer, was a businessman, a very successful person. Both have reached their middle years, and both have second thoughts about their career choice. The rabbi, even though he's achieved much in the world of scholarship, has second thoughts about his choice because of the lack of financial remuneration, perhaps the lack of recognition, and envies the businessman sitting nearby because of his success. The businessman, on the other hand, looks at the rabbi with envy. He's made a tremendous success of his life. But on the other hand, he looks about his spiritual accomplishments, of his intellectual accomplishments that were sacrificed because of his desire to make a living for his family and to make a success out of his career. Both are troubled. When another scholar walks into the room, the businessman, recognizing the spirituality, the learning of this scholar, stands up, greets him. "Hello, Rabbi." The first rabbi seated just gives a casual nod. "Nacha shlepev." Here's another scholar who didn't make it, and maybe should have chosen another career. When a businessman walks in, another successful person, the businessman seated looks at him, gives him a polite nod. The rabbi, on the other hand, stands up, gives him a warm handshake, treats him with the highest respect, because he looks, that person has made it. If we want to judge these two people sitting, again, this picture, the rabbi, the scholar, the intellectual, and the businessman, both with second thoughts about how they lived life and if they would have life to live over again. And I want to measure who is the more spiritual of the two. So Rav Huttner explained, according to this quote in Proverbs, "Ish lefi mahalolo," you define a person as to who he praises. The more spiritual of the two is that businessman. His accomplishments may not be something to boast of, but his respect and desire is great. And that's how you define a person. Not necessarily where he's at, but where he wants to be. When it comes to wisdom, and again, getting back to our original subject, the definition of a wise man is not necessarily how much you've collected, but what do you want now? What's important to you today? And listening, actively listening to someone, is the sign of a wise person. Because a person who listens is a person who's desirous of broadening their horizons, is a person desirous to add on to their own life. They don't know it all. Someone who interrupts, on the other hand, as we say, is a sign of foolishness. And that is the first quote, it is folly. The second part, he says, and a source of shame. Now there's, again, the situation here, someone is talking, is asking you a question, you don't let them finish, and you stop them short, and you start replying. What is the shame? There are two definitions. For now, we're going to go only the first. Later on, we're going to give the second. The first definition is, it's a shame for the listener. Because you know what? You may think that's what the person wants to ask, but very often you're off the mark. Don't be so smart. How many times, and it happens time and time again, someone starts asking a question, you come, yeah, that's what you mean, this is the answer. No, I didn't mean that. I meant something else. It doesn't make you look too good. You may think you're wise, but when it's shown up that you're not as wise, you don't have such great psychic abilities to really know what's on the person's mind, it doesn't really give you all that much honor. And after all, Wheel of Fortune is a great game to watch and perhaps participate in. But in real life, in the conversations between one person and another, we owe it to them to listen carefully and wait till they finish. So the first L is listen. The I is initiate. In dealing with a conversation, in dealing with communication, not always that the person we want to communicate to has asked us a question. Very often we have to initiate the communication. And sometimes we have to use ingenuity, because the person is not asking us after all. And here I quote in the notes, a tradition which was recorded in Talmudic sources. It's alluded to in the very famous quote in the beginning of Ovos from Hillel. Hillel is quoted saying that Havei mitalmidov shel Aaron, one should be of the disciples of Aaron. Oyev shalom, roidev shalom, person who loves peace, runs after peace. Oyev es abrios, loves humanity, makorv and latorah, brings him close to the Torah. What did this Aaron do? Aaron, we know, was the brother of Moses, of Moshe. What did he do? And here I have quoted, and let me just say this in my own words. When Aaron would see two people fight, he wanted to make peace amongst them. One is, and we're going to touch upon this a little later, normally one is not allowed to lie, but to make peace, one is allowed to. He would go to one of the parties after the fight and would make, let's say, a little white lie. He says, you know, I just spoke to your friends, your friend. You know, I know you had a falling out. He's besides himself. He doesn't know what to do. You know, he really is really ashamed. But he really doesn't have it within him to face you. He really holds you in the highest regard. But I don't know. I don't know how to get the two of you together. Then Aaron went from the first person, went to the second person and said the same white lie. You know, I just came back from your friend. You know, he's so embarrassed. You know, he told me, he says, you're such a wonderful person. He doesn't know what got into him to argue with you like that. You know, and I don't know how to bring both of you together, but you should know he really loves you. He holds you in the highest regard, but he's embarrassed to speak to you. Very often, as a result of Aaron's initiatives, when these two people would meet themselves in the street, they would both hug and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry. No, I'm so sorry." And this is the way Aaron made peace. He took the initiative. Very often, when it comes to communications, we don't have the luxury of waiting for them to come to us. We have to take the initiative to come to the other party. I'd like just to touch upon, I have another quote here, which we've quoted in a previous lecture here on page 3. I'd like to skip down. We're all familiar, one of the most classic pieces of Jewish literature is the Haggadah. Every family, almost without exception, comes together for the Passover Seder, and it says at least something of this work. In the Haggadah, we speak of the four sons. This quote of the four sons is not only found in the Haggadah, but it's found in other Talmudic materials from the Mechilta. And what about this son? Let's read this together. And regarding the one who was unable to ask, this is the son She'eino Yodea Lishol. You open conversation with him. As it says, and you will tell your son on that day, saying. The commentaries explain what is the idea of opening. And this is the Malbim's commentary on the Haggadah. He says, you know, you really can't tell somebody something. You can't lecture to somebody if they're not interested in listening. And the true way of delivering a message is to get the other person to ask. You have to cultivate the other person's interest. You have to get them to start asking questions. Once they start asking questions, then you can talk to them. Then you can give them answers. What do you do with a child or with a colleague who's not interested? He doesn't have any questions to ask. He feels he knows everything. So this is the Haggadah, the Higadata. This is the language, this is where the word Haggadah comes from. You start telling them a story. You get their interest. You develop their interest. And then they'll start asking. Sometimes you have to deal on a tangent. You can't tell the son about the story about the significance of Passover and how it fits in the overall scheme of Jewish life. It's beyond the child. But once you tell a story and you lead the child on or the person on, it's natural that at least in one part of the story, the person will start saying, and what happens now? Or how does that fit in? Or you have your opening. And that's at Pesach lo, make an opening. Pesach is an opening. You have to open conversation with him. And this is Vigadatul Abincho Bayomahu. You have to tell him the story lay more in order to eventually come to the punchline, which you can never tell directly. Only after you've engaged the person in conversation. So this is the eye of initiative. You have to get them to ask. You have to arouse their curiosity. So again, L for listen is listen. One should be an active listener because, again, we said that a philosopher, philosoph, is he who loves wisdom. Listen to what the other person is saying. Don't interrupt that person. And I, sometimes you don't have the situation is not such that the person is talking to you, but you want to talk to the other person. Just don't wait. Take the initiative. And if he doesn't have the interest, arouse that interest. S of listen is silence. And again, as we spoke, part of it, as we said, is the notion, don't anticipate the person's question. The person speaking to you, don't anticipate what he's going to say. Let the person finish. Very often it's not a question it's not a situation of a question. The person is stating an opinion. You want to have a reply. And very often we just don't have the patience and we want to cut the person short and say, wait a minute here, you know, and you want to say to express your opinion in the middle while the person hasn't even finished speaking. And this is the quote from Ovos we have on page 3, that the sign of a wise person, of a learned person, he does not interrupt the words of his fellow. We stated before in the first quote that interrupting someone is a source of shame. One interpretation we said is it's a shame for the person who's interrupting, because very often you just don't get, you think you got the gist of what the person's saying, but since you didn't let the person finish, very often you're in error and it's just embarrassing for you. There's another explanation of the S of the idea of shame. And that it's a shame for the person you're cutting short. Because very often the person wants to say it. And you're cutting them short, says, yeah, I heard it already. I know what you have to say. It's not really worth hearing. Let me tell you something. And it's very often, we don't realize it, but it's offensive to the person you're speaking to. If it's in public, it could really go into the general heading of someone who embarrasses another person in public, which we know from Talmudic sources if he's really shamed by it, doesn't have a portion of the world to come. You know, it's really looked at that shaming a person in public is the equivalent of killing a person. We're just so caught up. And what we want to say, we don't realize that we're dealing with emotions. It's not just ideas. I'm reminded of a joke. It's an ethnic joke. I'm not going to say the ethnic backgrounds of the people. I'll leave it to your imagination. But there's a joke that goes how many, when you tell a joke to a person of a certain ethnic group, how many times does he laugh? And the answer to this particular group is 3. Once when you tell the joke. Once, because you tell from the laugh, the person really didn't get the joke. Once when you explain the joke. And the third time is finally when the person gets the joke. That's one group. Another group, and I've got to leave it to your imagination, says, again, how many times, when you tell this group the joke, how many times they laugh? And the answer is twice. Once when you tell the joke. Once when you explain the joke, there's no third time because they never get the joke. Right? How many times does a Jew laugh when you tell him a joke? And the answer is none. Because they interrupt you in the middle and they say, no, no, that's not the way it goes. You're supposed to tell this way. But from our sources, it seems that's not good policy. When someone is talking, you should listen. Key for listen, the T is truth. And again, looking at the source that we quote, again from Ovos, again, the sign, this again is the sign of a wise person. So concerning that which he has not heard, he says, I have not heard, I don't know about it. Very often people like to pose as an expert. I don't know if you've ever looked at the Encyclopedia Britannica. There's an awful lot of subjects that I'm sure, I know for myself, are not an expert on. There's only so much time you have in life, and you're only given, the gifts are limited. A person should have the integrity of saying, and I just don't know. Just because a person has a degree and one has studied Talmud his whole life and is a rabbi, or one has studied medicine their whole life as a doctor, or law their whole life and is a lawyer, doesn't mean they know every single thing about the subject. I don't think it's expected of the person. And the person should have the honesty, says, you know, I don't know. There's another aspect of truth. You know, very often, it depends how, for others it's more often this. And for others, we make mistakes. And we give wrong opinions, wrong answers. And sometimes it's very hard to retract. But the sign of a wise person is to go back. Once you've given an answer, says, you know, I thought about it again. I've looked it up. You know, I made a mistake. We're not doing anybody a service by living a life of a lie and misinforming someone. And if we have misinformed someone, and really, we shouldn't expect that much of ourselves, to, you know, to be so ashamed as, you know, here I made a mistake. And we're human, and we're limited. And again, as we started beginning, the sign of a wise person is not much how much he has accomplished, but how much he wants, he loves learning and wants more learning, wants to accomplish. And the fact is that we haven't accomplished it. There's nothing to be ashamed of. You know, that's the human condition. And we should have the integrity of admitting our errors. You know, and if we've misinformed someone, to tell them. The Talmud is a Gemara in Sota, 42a, that describes 4 groups that will never see the face of the divine presence. One of them is the group of liars. God doesn't like liars either. There are times one is allowed to lie. We stated before, to maintain peace. There are other situations that Talmud deals with. In terms of humility, if someone asks you about your great successes or your great accomplishments, you're allowed to lie because of modesty. You're allowed to lie not to damage other people. Someone invites you over their home, their hospitality is unbelievable. You're not doing your host a favor like telling the whole world about the person's hospitality. You know, everybody in the, you know, and his brother, his brother will be on the person's door. You know, if they asked you, how was it? Okay. You think that you're doing the person a favor by saying, oh, he was great and wonderful. You know, that guy didn't know how many new friends he'll be getting. You know, what hit the person. So it's to protect other people you are allowed to lie. But under normal circumstances, you should try to tell the truth. It's not just something which is preferred, but it seems from the Talmud, it's something which is a must. The E, again, let's go. L is listen. Let's listen to the whole conversation and actively listen. Sometimes when they're not talking, initiate. If you want to get your message, don't wait for them. And sometimes you have to create the interest. S, silence, is don't interrupt. And it's not only sometimes a source of shame for you, anticipating a question, but it's really an insult to the person speaking. T, tell the truth. Someone asks you a question, and you don't know the answer, just says, I don't know. And if you've made a mistake, have the courage to go back and say, you know, I looked it up, you know, I found that there was an error, and I want to correct the error. E is empathy. Very often when we speak to people, we don't have the answers to their problems. And again, we're limited. We just don't have all the answers. But one thing we can give a person is the sense that person is not alone. You know, we don't have to give any pat answers. Some people just want a sounding board. Some people just want to feel that somebody else, they can share it with someone else, even though the other person has no answers. I'm reminded of a cartoon that I saw some months ago. There was somebody in a drugstore speaking to the attendant there. This is in front of the Get Well card section. And the cartoon reads, says, I want a card that says, I had it too, only worse. That's not the sympathy most people are looking for. So part of a communication, and part, again, we said communication is a two-way street. You listen, you reply. Very often we don't have a reply. But just listening with empathy, with feeling, is more than enough. Sometimes people just don't want just answers. I remember some years back, I went into an advertising agency, and there was a big sign on the wall. Answers, $1.50. Answers with some thought, $2.50. The correct answer, $3.50. Sometimes no answer is better than just an answer. There's another area of empathy that's very important, which doesn't go so much in terms of the listening, but in terms of the actual conversation. And this is a story that I read some months ago. It's a beautiful story about a beautiful individual. One of the legendary individuals, personalities, in Israel in the 20th century was Rav Arya Levine. Rav Arya Levine, he's the subject of a book, a wonderful book, I don't know if it's still in print, called Tzaddik in Our Times. He was besides his scholarship and his saintliness, he volunteered to be the rabbi of the prisoners, the Jewish prisoners under the British mandate. And he was the rabbi of the underground prisoners, of the Irgun, of Lehi. He used to visit them. He used to convey messages from their families that they didn't feel that they're totally cut off from the world. He came there every Shabbos and davened with them. And he used to there's an Erev in Yerushalayim, in Kerry, Yerushalayim, and his wife had it inside the pockets. She used to put these letters in a way that the British guards wouldn't detect them. The underground actually used it as a way of conveying information from the prison to the men out in the field. He was very much beloved by virtually every sector of Jewry in Israel. When he died, I think it was 1969, there wasn't probably Jews from every single political persuasion was there at his funeral. The following story is about Rav Aryeh Levin, but I'd like to just give an additional historic background to this story. Up until the beginning of the 19th century, it was rare to find a Jew who did not keep Shabbos or did not have his store closed on Shabbos. It just was a rarity. By the end of the end of the 19th century, at least in Western Europe and in America, it was no longer a rarity. And by the beginning, the first two decades of the 20th century, it was no longer a rarity in Eastern Europe either. The setting of our story is Yerushalayim, the city of Jerusalem, where at that time a store opened on Shabbos was still rare. And there was a store opened on, at least Friday, I don't know if it was on a Saturday, but it was on Friday night after sunset, was still open. And despite the cajoling and the harassing and the speaking of different neighbors and rabbis, the proprietor still refused to close his shop. So Rav Aryeh Levin heard about this, didn't know about it, he didn't live in that neighborhood. He knew the shopkeeper, he knew the person, and it was late Friday afternoon. He had already prepared for Shabbos. He was already dressed. And he came to the shop, and there was a hustle and bustle of the customers going in and out, and he sat himself in a corner and was just sitting and watching. And the proprietor came over to him and asked him, "Is there anything I can help you with? Is there anything?" And he said, no, I just want to sit here. And the proprietor didn't understand what was happening. A little while later, he came again over to the rabbi. He says, "Rabbi, you're sitting here, you're doing nothing. You know, what are you here for?" He says, "Let me tell you. I heard, from others that you didn't close your store before the beginning of Shabbos, and I couldn't understand it. There must be a reason. So I came here, I sat down, and I watched the hustle and bustle, and I see it's very difficult for you to close your house shop on Shabbos. Because there's so much business, it's hard to get them out of the store. And it's so tempting, and here you evidently are doing well right now. And for you to close right now, it's a real sacrifice." And he held the person's hand, and he says, "But what can I tell you? Shabbos is Shabbos." So the proprietor replied, says, "You're the first person who's come over to me that's taken my side. People have come over to me, called me all kinds of names. Says, you're the first person who at least understands my situation. And you took the trouble to see what I'm..." He says, "I can't make any guarantees, but I'll think it over." By the next Shabbos, this person's store was closed. The moral of the story is, and it goes just beyond the narrow confines of this story, it says, if you want to influence another person, you can't be an antagonist. The relationship cannot be me against you. I know better than you. It says, you don't know what you're doing. I know what's good for you. You have to take you have to be his protagonist. You have to take the person's side. You have to see the struggle that the person is taking. Only then, as a true friend, can you go and share your feelings. So the E, again, the E of listen is empathy. Again, it's two sides. One is sometimes, even if we don't say anything, it suffices we've listened and we've made the person feel that there's a kindred soul who cares. And the second is that when we are offering advice, it's important that we come there as the person's friend and really truly understand what the person is going through. N is a need. Very often in life, we take the attitude, one size fits all. You know? What's good for me is good for you, is good for everybody. You know, we are all made differently. You know, the Talmud describes a story that in the city, we are from the story of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, Sodom and Gomorrah, there was a bed in Sodom, in Sodom, that was made to discourage. They didn't want people to visit. They were self-sufficient. They didn't want people to come and visit. It would be a burden on them. So in order to discourage people from coming, they had a special bed for their guests. It was one size. In life, one size does not fit all. Just as you come to a tailor shop, the suit you're wearing that was good for someone else is not good for you. It has to be tailored. It has to be adjusted. When you give people advice, when you communicate, you have to realize you're speaking to a unique individual who has unique needs, who hears unique messages. And instead of giving like the flippant answer, why don't you think, what does that person need to hear? And it reminds me of a story that I read in there was a magazine that came out, I don't know if it's still in circulation, called Mosaic, a Digest. It was supposed to be a Jewish Reader's Digest. And in it, it had the following story. A fellow ordered a custom-made suit from a tailor in the Lower East Side of New York. When he came to try it on, he noticed that the left sleeve was too short. "That's no problem," said the tailor. "All you have to do is lean a little to the left and stretch out your arm." The fellow tried it, but found that the jacket bunched up at the collar. "That's no problem," says, "just lean a little bit forward." But leaning forward created new problems at the waist. "No problem," said the tailor, "just twist your body a little to the right." So sure enough, by stretching out to the left, leaning forward and twisting to the right, the jacket lay perfectly. In this contorted form, the fellow walked out into the street wearing his new jacket. Two people standing across the street looked at him and turned to each other. "Look at that poor fellow," said the first. "Imagine having to go through life with such a handicap." "Terrible," said the other. "But look at how that jacket fits him. He sure has a great tailor." Hopefully when we tailor our answers and replies to the people, we should do a better job. The next, first was listen. The next is respect. In Pirkei Avos, we quoted before, who is a wise person? Who learns from every person? Who is a person who gets respect? Who is an honored person? And the answer is a person who honors others. If you want to gain respect, you have to give respect. You're all familiar with Dale Carnegie's best-selling book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. One of the main principles that he goes over again and again is the idea that you truly have to respect other people if you're going to get other people to listen to you. There's a, we quoted Proverbs before, there's another wonderful quote in Proverbs. It's Kamayim Haponim Laponim. Just like water reflects a person's image, you see your face in the water. Kein Lev Ha'odom La'odom. So is a heart of a man to a man. People instinctively pick up on your feelings. If you respect them, they feel it. And if you just flatter them, if in your heart you really don't hold them in the highest regard, but you're just flattering them, they feel it also. You're not fooling anyone. So an important one of the major principles and how to get your point across is to make sure the listener realizes you truly respect them. And as we've discussed in previous lectures, it says a human being is such a phenomenal creation, every one of us, that there's so much to respect. Every one of us. You have to realize every one of us, how great we are, has failings. And in some respect, we don't share common failings. There are areas that another person excels in, and the other person excels in yet another area. We're all great. And besides that, we have a special, unique greatness to each one of us. And its importance is that if we want to make the point, we should start looking at the person differently. Because after all, says that this is, as we've discussed before, every human being is a indescribable spiritual creation with intelligence and feeling and power to change their lives and other lives. So it's important to have that attitude whenever you speak to someone else. E is elucidate. One of the major problems of communication is we don't make ourselves clear. You know, when it comes to if you're an employer or a manager, you have people working under you, it could be disastrous if the information that you're giving to those who are under you is not clear. It may be correct, but it's not clear. It reminds me of the story. You know, there's a story told about, this goes back in the old days of the Soviet Union, and the CIA sent one of their spies to make a contact in an apartment building in Moscow. The name of the person they were supposed to contact was Shapiro, but they were not given the apartment number. And when the person from the CIA came to the apartment building, read the names of the occupants, there were two Shapiros. Which one is the spy? So he'll try the first. Says, and he knocks on the door, says, are you Mr. Shapiro? He said in Russian, he says, yeah. He says, the sun is shining brightly. Oh, you must mean the other Shapiro. It always happens. The spy Shapiro, third floor to the left. When you give instructions, you know, think before you leap. It has to be clear. I'm reminded of another story, again with not such favorable results. There's a story of a Chinaman. This goes back in New York City in the beginning of the 20th century. There was a Chinaman who was working in a laundry on the Lower East Side, and person brings his laundry and they make conversation. The person asks the Chinaman, says, what's your name? And he says, Chaim Hershkovitz. He says, Chaim Hershkovitz? That's not a name for someone from China. Yeah, that's not my original name, but that's the name they gave me. He says, how did that happen? Well, it's a long story, but you know, we're processed in Ellis Island. There was a whole line of immigrants. The man in front of me, you know, he asked him, what's your name? He just Chaim Hershkovitz. So he signed, did all the paperwork and everything. And then they came to me, and he says, "And sir, what's your name?" He says, "Me same thing." What's your name again? "Me same thing." Okay, and I too became Chaim Hershkovitz. So it's very important when you're giving your messages to make it clear. The S is succinct. We quote from the Gemara in Pesachim, says in Gimel and Beis in 3b, that when you teach, as a teacher, make sure that what you're saying is concise, to the point. Otherwise it won't be remembered. People's attention spans are not all that great. So if you have something to say, try to keep it short. I know my wife is looking at me here. But try to keep it short. You know, I'm reminded of the story. You know? Yeah. I'm reminded of the story of the, as we know, I just came from the Beis Yehuda dinner, which was on Sunday night. Generally, every major organization that has a dinner brings in a special speaker. And generally, in order to make sure that everyone stays through the whole program, and inevitably there's not just one speaker, there are various speakers, there are various honorees, there are people that have to be given various plaques and honors, they try to keep it short. In this particular organization, there was a planning committee about how to arrange the dinner, and they were bringing in a very prestigious speaker from out of town. He was charging them a mint. But hopefully, because he was a famous name speaker, he would bring in the crowds. And as they were planning those who are going to be honored, and those the acceptance speeches, and those who are going to introduce this speaker and that speaker, they came to Sam. Sam was one of the hardest workers of that organization. He was a person that the organization really couldn't work. You couldn't even think about that organization without Sam. He was a tireless worker. He had to be honored. He had to be given a slot in that dinner. But Sam had a slight problem. He loved to speak. And there was the fear that as he would be droning on, people would be leaving. The guest speaker wouldn't have anyone to speak to. And they had to somehow get Sam to agree to keep his words to the bare minimum. So the chairman of the planning committee says, "I know Sam personally. We went to grade school together. Leave it to me." And the head of the planning committee, who was the dinner chairman, went over to Sam, explained everything. He says, "We've worked it out." Says that every speaker has agreed we're going to keep the program, even though we have a lot of speakers before the main speaker, but we're going to keep it between 2 and 3 minutes maximum. So all the speakers, you know, in total will be perhaps 15 minutes, and we'll be able to give the guest speaker all the time he needs to deliver his address. "Sam, I'm making a special exception in your case. You can speak for 4 minutes, but please don't speak a second more than 4 minutes." And Sam says, "I understand. Don't worry." They came to the dinner. The dinner was a success. It was a sellout crowd. And as the honors were being given and plaques were being awarded, every speaker kept to the schedule between 2 and 3 minutes. And now it was the highlight of the evening. The guest speaker was about to begin his address, but he was to be introduced by Sam. And Sam got up, and there was a full crowd there. No one had left. They'd kept the program to extremely short. And Sam got up, and he started talking. 4 minutes went by. 5 minutes. 7 minutes. The dinner chairman was looking at his watch, and he was plotting as he saw one person get up to leave, another person, another person. He looks at the clock, 15 minutes have passed, and Sam is just warming up. And he was beside himself. He didn't know what to do. And he looked at the guest speaker, and the guest speaker didn't look too good himself either. He didn't know how long he was going to stay. And he had to do something. And he took the gavel. He got up to hit Sam over the head. But unfortunately, he missed. And instead of hitting Sam, he hit the guest speaker. And as the guest speaker slumped in his chair and started sliding under the table, the last words that came out of the mouth of the guest speaker was, "Hit me again. I could hear Sam still talking." It's important to keep it short. But very often, when it comes to organizational speeches, and you have more than one speech, it's not just a matter of keeping every individual speech short, but to minimize the number of speakers you have. And I'm reminded of another story. This story really has some history to it. This goes back to the days of ancient Rome, where in order to feed the thirst of the Roman crowds, they used to have these gladiatorial matches. Sometimes who had trained gladiators, and it was a real professional combat. They were actually trained in schools, and it was a real performance. Other situations, the people were literally fed to the lions. They were given perhaps, either they had nothing, or perhaps a small knife. They're almost without any arms, and they had to face animals that had not been fed for days, who had a taste of human blood. And the story is about a poor Jewish victim in the middle of one of these stadiums who was condemned to die in the stadium. And here he was in the middle of this great amphitheater. Thousands of people are around waiting for the moment. They release the lion. The lion paces, ready to go in for the kill. And with this, since the Jew does not wait, he runs to the lion and whispers something in the ear of the lion. And the lion emits a roar that was probably unprecedented in Roman history. And that poor lion was shaking, ran back to its corner, and had to be carried out. The people in the amphitheater had never seen such a sight. They rose to their feet, cheered that poor Jew in the middle. Since the crowds went onto the stadium floor, lifted him up, and carried him out a free man. As he was leaving, the emperor, who happened to be in the crowd, went over to this newly free man, took him aside, and says, "I won't tell anybody, but what did you do? How did you do that? I've been to hundreds of games. Nothing like this has ever occurred." So the Jew looked at the emperor and says, "Emperor, it was quite simple. I just told him," says, "I'm Jewish, and when you go to a Jewish banquet, you have to stay for all the speeches." So the S is succinct. The P of respect is persuasive. Being persuasive is not only being articulate. Does not just have the ability to utter cogent arguments, but it's a matter of tone as well. There's the body English. It's not so much what you say, but how you say it. I remember reading the story about the teacher who comes to the unruly classroom and bangs on the desk and screams, "I demand pandemonium!" There was silence. You could hear a pin drop. And the teacher said, "You know what? It's not what you say, but how you say it." The Talmud brings in an important illustration of this point. One of the great mitzvahs of the Torah, it's one of the Ten Commandments, is to honor your parents. And the Talmud makes the statement, it's possible to give pheasants, the greatest delicacy, to your parent and not have a portion in the world to come. And on the other hand, a person could force their father into servitude, to grind a mill, an elderly father, and this will bring that son into the world to come. And the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Talmud created in Israel, explains there was once a son who fed his father the most precious, the greatest delicacies. And the father asked the son, "How could you afford this?" And the son says, "What business is a yours, old man? Just chew." He gave him to eat. But it's not a matter of just giving. It's a matter of how you give, how you express yourself. On another occasion, it happened to another person. A man was engaged in grinding a millstone. That's what he did for a living. His father, this man's father, was called to the draft. We have to be drafted in, says, into the army. And the son said to the father, "Listen over here, it's dangerous. And you're an older person. How in the battlefield, how would you be able to react? You take care of this millstone. It'll feed you and my family, our families, and I'll go in your stead." So that son merited the world to come. Again, it's not so much what you say, but the feeling behind what you're saying. To persuade someone is not merely a matter, again, of just saying the right words. It's the empathy that we've explained before. It's your sense of conviction. You have to be convinced what you're doing is right. Just saying the words is just words. P is persuasive. And persuasive, we understand here, is not just the message, but how that message is delivered. E is ego. Very often our egos get in the way of what we want to do in life. We quoted the Talmud says in Maseches Tomid 32a, we've quoted this in a previous lecture. When Alexander the Great came to Israel, he had a long conversation with the sages. And Alexander asked him, "What should a person do to make himself alive, to enjoy life, to get the most out of life?" And the answer was just to kill himself. And it was a metaphor to lower oneself, to humble oneself. If you want to be beloved, if you want to live a pleasant life, become a humble person. Everyone loves someone who's not a threat, who's humble. If when you're humble, you respect others, people feel comfortable in your presence. Alexander asked, "What should a person do to kill himself, to come to an untimely death?" And the answer was, try to make yourself alive. In other words, try to build yourself up. Try to expand your ego, because no one likes an arrogant person. What you're going to land up is you're going to become frustrated and aggravated. So people aren't giving you the respect that you're trying to foist upon them. And you're an unhappy person. What you think, the irony is, you think that you will gain by building yourself up, and the truth is, all you're doing is lowering yourself. And on the contrary, when you humble yourself and give respect to other people, people love you for it. In terms of communicating, you have an idea to tell someone. You want to convince that person. We've discussed different elements of this. We've discussed the empathy, the feeling for someone, the idea of the persuasive, the idea of your of how not only what you say, but how you say it, and your conviction. But it's important, your overall tenor, your overall approach is that of someone who's truly a humble person, respects someone else. People have confidence in such a person. You know what? You're not doing it for yourself. I know you have nothing in mind for yourself. You must mean it with true conviction, so that you must have with me in mind. So E is for ego. If we want to develop our communicative skills, it's important to develop our sense of humility. C is compliment. And again, Dale Carnegie found this is one of the most important tools to win someone over is to compliment them. But not flattery, not the false compliment. It's a compliment because everyone deserves and wants to be complimented, because we, each one of us, have so many wonderful, wonderful things that we have. There's so many aspects of our personality that one is worthy of being complimented. So don't be afraid to compliment someone. It shouldn't look like flattery. And this is the quote, that one does not sing a person's total praises in their presence. Don't look like a flatterer. But it's always nice to say a good word. People appreciate it. People realize you're their friend. You can make you've made the setting. You've created the atmosphere to really make an impression, because they know you're their friend. T is trust. We discussed the T before of truth. You should be a person who admits the truth, admits your errors, admits the fact that you don't have all the answers. There's another aspect, and that's the idea when you give people advice, it should be for the other person's benefit, not for your own. You know, there's a famous story. Again, this goes back to Israel over 100 years ago. One of the great rabbis was Yeshua Leib Diskin. And there was a certain, I forget the exact details, but there was a certain problem of an employee-employer problem. And both of them came for advice on different occasions. And he advised the employer and the employee differently. He gave them different advice. And afterwards they came over to him and says, hey, wait a minute. You know, this is the same problem, and you advised the other party differently. He says, I advise them what's important for them. You know, it's like a lawyer. He says an attorney is hired to give the best advice to their client. You don't have to think about this agenda or that agenda. Someone asks you for advice. Your responsibility is what is the best thing for that person. Of course, it has to be moral, it has to be ethical. But within the confines of morality and ethics, what is the best advice for that person? The person, after all, is coming to you for advice. He's trusting you. You should return that trust. I'm just reminded of a very cute story I've heard many years ago about a kosher Chinese restaurant in New York, where the maitre d' of that restaurant, who was a Chinaman, spoke perfect Yiddish. And people came in, and he would sit them down, and he would speak like a real Litvish Yiddish. He spoke an impeccable Yiddish. And the people not only enjoyed the meal, but they enjoyed the service as well. And afterwards, they called over the manager of the restaurant and asked him, says, how did you get someone from China to speak Yiddish? He says, shh, I told him when I hired him that I teach him English. But the story was that they had used this person, thinking that it was English. He was an immigrant. He was willing to work because they would teach him English. And then while they taught him Yiddish because it would further the restaurant business. People come to you for advice. They trust you. Return that trust. So let's just quickly summarize, and let me tell you another story. Okay. It's listen, respect. Let's just summarize here. This is L, listen. Be an active listener. Listen to the person, because every person is a font of wisdom. And don't interrupt them in the middle. Don't think, oh yeah, I know what you mean to say. Hear them out. I initiate. Very often you just don't have the luxury of having them come to ask you. You have to take the initiative. Very often has a lot of ingenuity, like the thing of Aaron, who went over to make peace between the two feuding parties. Very often that you have to give a message to someone. You can't tell the person directly. You have to go around and about to cultivate the person's, arouse the person's interest. Get that person to start asking questions, then you could start talking. Because the person's not asking, he's not interested. So you have to create that interest. So the S is silence. So don't interrupt someone in the middle. T is truth. Don't be afraid to say, I don't know. And don't be afraid to say, I made a mistake. This is the correct answer. E, empathy. Very often we don't have all the answers. But the very fact that we can just sit and sympathize with a person is a service of it itself. And also, when you do want to communicate something, remember the story of Aria 11, says you have to get into that person's shoes. And the person should feel that he has a friend, a protagonist, who is really taking his side, who is giving him advice rather than an antagonist. N is need. You should tailor your message to the need. As we said, we speak of the four sons. This is the Haggadah on Passover. It says the wise one, the wicked one, the naive one, the one who is unable to ask. There are four separate answers. We have to tailor our response to the needs of the people we're speaking to. And don't forget the story about that tailor in the Lower East Side. R is respect. It says, if you respect others, people respect you. And you create the backdrop. You create the atmosphere, then you can really communicate. So E is elucidate. Be clear. This is the quote that we have here as from the Mechilta, in terms of when Moses was told to teach the Torah, he was told he should put it in front of him like a shulchan oruch, like a set table. That's the source of why the code of Jewish law is called shulchan oruch, the set table. It should be clear. Remember, mi sem ting. Right? S is succinct. It says, keep it short. Remember Sam and the gavel. And not too many speakers at an affair. Remember the lion. P is persuasive. It says, it's not just what you say, but how you say it. We quoted from the Gemara in Brachos and Yud Zion, a soft answer turneth away wrath. It isn't what you've said, it's the tone. It's the conviction, it's the feeling. Ego, one of the major barriers that we have to communicate to others is our own ego. So if we, it has to go hand in hand with developing our communicative skills is our own personality. To the extent that we've gained greater humility, we'll have greater powers of persuasion. C, compliment. It says, don't be hesitant to compliment other people. Not too much. Don't flatter them. Don't make it sound insincere. But everyone needs to be complimented. Everyone has so much in their lives that you can truly compliment them with. So it's a compliment. And again, this will create the atmosphere for you to communicate, be persuasive. T, trust, says people who are coming to you are trusting in you, want your advice, want your guidance. Don't betray that trust. It says don't use people. Remember the story about the maitre d', the Chinese maitre d'. I know I'm talking a little too much, but let me end with this very cute story. Okay. This again has to do with speakers. And again, this was a major Jewish organization, and a guest speaker was flown from out of town. And it was a very, very drawn out evening. And as the evening as the evening went on, and the speeches and the honors were given and the plaques, people started leaving the ballroom. Some in pairs, some in tens, in droves. By the time the guest speaker got up to speak, there was only one person in the audience. And the guest speaker figures there's only one person in the audience. I mean, I might as well sit down and just pack up. But he gave it second thought. You know, if there's at least one person had the decency to stay through the entire evening and wait for his speech, that person deserves his total attention. And he spoke to that one person as if there would be 1,000 people in that audience with all the feeling and intonation. And after he was finished and he wiped his brow, says he got off of the dais and walked over to the person and thanked him, shook his hand warmly and thanked him, says, thank you for at least you of all people stayed to hear my address. And the person replied, oh no, really, it was nothing, it was nothing. You see, I'm the next speaker.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.